When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everyone, and welcome along to the Rangers Rabble podcast. We may be in the midst of a winter break, but the content doesn't stop here on the Rabble. We still want to bring you some analysis of all things going on in Rangers and also something slightly different tonight. We thought we would do a bit of a mid-season review, a bit of a scorecard in terms of what's happened so far this season. The gents with me this evening, they might look at it, they've maybe drawn the short straw, but actually I think this is maybe the interesting show because we're going to split this in two. So we're going to take you through from the start of the season up until when Michael Beale left the club. And then I believe later this week, Martin and some of the chaps will come on and talk about the time from when Philippe Clement has came in and probably look ahead in terms of the rest of the transfer window and what their hopes are for the rest of the season. Joining me this evening is Connor. Connor, how's things? Fresh from quiz duty last night?
Yes, well, much like the Michael Beale era, I'm trying to put that behind me now. But
you just learn. Are you learning from? You've got to learn from those experiences.
I'll be better the next time. You know what I mean? I'll go away and learn the lessons by doing precisely nothing at all. And I'll just hope I'll be better the next time. So, very much the real treatment for me. It was a good laugh. I might have had a few faux pas, but at the end of the day, you know, I'm hoping that I'll have a better showing this evening.
I'm sure you will. Richie, how are we?
Yeah, all good. Thanks, Stuart. Yeah, not so sure that I'm looking forward to this Beale Ball review. I am in some ways, but yeah, who doesn't like a good old kick in the bollocks from time to time? So yeah, we'll see how that works out.
Exactly.
In terms of the quiz, I didn't do too much better, Connor, playing from home. So yeah, fair play to you.
Yeah, it takes a bit of guts to put yourself in front of the camera and that one for a quiz night. And finally, Wolf, how are we?
I'm fine, Stuart, thanks. I'm not mentioning the quiz because I'll probably be on it this coming Sunday, so I'm not saying anything because I'll probably have a brain fart as soon as it starts, and I'll probably, any answer I don't know, the answer will be Ron Wallace. So without any question. So.
Yeah, probably safer to do that, Will. Okay, then, before we get into the half-season review then, we just touch on some of the kind of stories that are kind of floating about at the moment, and in particular what seems to be the kind of growing momentum, Connor, that Ridvan Yilmaz is probably going to be on his way. Looks as if if the rumours are to be believed, and let's say they are growing, is that he's on his way to Italy. What's your thoughts on that? Is it is it smart because he's a sellable asset and it might allow the manager to kind of do some things? Or are we potentially losing someone that we were just starting to see what he's capable of?
Well, it depends. I mean, if we get a decent enough fee for him, and you know, the figures I'm seeing banding about kind of ranging for sort of 4 to 6 million, I think's the kind of the ballpark figure we're looking at. Of course, the part of the issue we've got is, I believe, that Besiktas have got a 20% sell-on clause that they will obviously have to receive some cash from as well. So, I mean, yeah, it's, I'd prefer if we were able to keep him, because I do think we've seen sparks from him this season of what he's capable of. And I think, you know, we'd probably all agree that with the way that Bonner's been playing, and to the point that Greg Guthrie's made there, you know, if you'd given us the choice about which one we'd rather have kept, it would have been Yilmaz all day long, because you feel as if Bonner's kind of passed, you know, his peak really at Rangers, whereas Yilmaz, I feel, not always, because he's, you know, he's had some bad games here or there, but, you know, in the main, he's been a breath of fresh air when he's come in and started games. He's had that real energy down that left-hand side that we're not getting so much out of Barisic. I mean, I think the only time I've seen him take on a player and beat him and you know, to get a goal was in the, oh, I can't remember, was it St. Johnston game, I think it might have been, for the second goal when he crosses it in the box.
Cup final as well, I think it was a cup final.
The cup final, that was exactly the one. You're absolutely right, the cup final when he done that, you know, so he's lost that, you know, real, I don't think he's lost the ability, I think he's just lost the confidence to take on his man like that, whereas Yilmaz has been full of that. You know, he's done that time and again. I mean, I've seen him score what I would consider one of the goals of the season when I was sat next to Wilf in the club deck for the Livingston game in the League Cup quarter-final, when he just absolutely ran through the middle of them. And you can obviously talk about how poor they are, but that is a terrific goal that he scored. And that's the kind of confidence he's got. You'll never get that out of Bonner. So I think my bigger concern would be, if he's gone and we get the money, that's great. But are we then going to go and bring in another left-back? Are we going to revert Dujon Sterling back to his more natural position and see if he works in there? I just don't know. Personally, I wouldn't do that with Sterling, because he's been doing so well in the midfield. It almost feels like we'd be missing out and having him there if we did move him back. So it's one of these kind of ones, time will tell, because we've had, particularly during the summer window there was one or two that we lost that I think, you know, on reflection, we kind of look back and go, might have been worth keeping them. I hope that Ridvan doesn't become one of those players. However, obviously, if he goes to Verona and whatever, then, you know, you wish him well and you wish him the best, because I do think that Verona will be getting a pretty decent player, all things considered. And he's still young enough that he'll develop and get even better, in my opinion.
Richie, what's your thoughts on this? In terms of, you know, we obviously don't know the full situation, that there could be, the player could be pushing for this, you know, maybe he's wanting to move closer to home. But in terms of what Connor's saying, I would find it difficult to accept if we did this, if the manager hasn't got somebody in mind to come in and kind of replace him. You know, I don't know if I'd be keen going with Sterling and Bonner for the rest of the season. And the reason I say that is, Yilmaz was taking up positions in the park, clearly at the manager's instruction, that he wasn't saying to Bonner. You know, he was moving inside, he was creating an overload in the middle of the park, whereas when Bonner played under Clement, he's never done that, because he clearly realises that that's not his skill set, but Yilmaz did give you that. You know, if it is the case that he's going to move on, surely the managers get somebody lined up, you would think?
Yeah, I would have thought so. I mean, it's in terms of the profile of player, I much prefer watching Ridvan and, you know, what he offers to the team over what Bonner's been able to offer of late. And I can't imagine for a second that this move's being considered without an alternative, or maybe even two alternatives already in mind. I think we were all sort of at the beginning of the season, and we'll touch upon this, I'm sure, in the sort of review of the first part of the season. But, you know, Barisic was one of the players that came under some scrutiny for, you know, the lateral backwards passing, hugging the touchline. It just all seems quite predictable. And when you're wanting to play with wing backs as your sort of main source of going forward, that you need that sort of variation, or, you know, dare I say it, sort of more of a modern style of play, creating the different options, like you said, and always looking to go forward and exchange a pass with somebody in the holding midfield. And I think that certainly is something that Yilmaz was able to offer us more than Borna. Whether that makes him the answer, I'm not so sure. And it might just be one of those scenarios where we were longing for something different, and we saw it in patches when he got a run in the team. And let's not forget, he was unfortunate with injuries. There were times when he just started to get going, and then he was set back again. And obviously, he was controversially left out of the European squad as well. And we can, you know, we've all had our opinions on that. But I think ultimately, we won't really know until we know exactly who he's being replaced with. We've seen some of the rumours. He's one of only a few kind of saleable assets, I would say, in the current squad. We haven't got a lot of them, particularly with the form of some of the signings that we've made in the summer. And if it's a case that we're able to get our money back or make a small profit on him, and Clermont has a couple of interesting players in the pipeline that suit his philosophy, then I'm all for it. But as you said, it's very hard to answer. I can't contemplate a scenario where we're just cashing in and then we're going to see what we can do with Barisic and Sterling, who he's played much more of his career on the right hand side. I think it's fair to say, even though we've seen him in this sort of midfield role looking very competent, I don't think I'd like to see a sort of a Barisic and Sterling partnership to replace what we'd get from Yilmaz. So I'm sure there'll be somebody else coming in, and there'll be the rumours will intensify. But it's not what I'm not going to be, you know, incredibly sad to see him go, subject to getting somebody of a kind of profile that Clermont would like.
Yeah, just on Neil Sharpie's question there, I think the rumours are it's around about $3 million potentially that would be the fee. I think we paid roughly 3.5 or something like that for him. So there might be a slight loss on that. But Wilf, you know, there's talk Josh Doig potentially, you know, could you see some sort of negotiation there where, you know, they get Yilmaz, we get Josh Doig. Would you be happy with that sort of profile of player? Doig was a guy that I really liked to look at when he was at Hibs, and was hoping that we would have made a move for when it was clear that he was leaving Hibs. What's your thoughts on Josh Doig?
I was the same when he was leaving Hibs. I thought we should possibly have gone for him. I don't know how he's been getting on in Verona. I believe he's been playing. So if they've been playing him, it strikes me as quite strange that they want to replace him with Yilmaz. Because if they're going to be spending, I know they're a Serie A team, but I mean, if they're going to be paying what £3 million for a left back, you would imagine they're going to play him. So that would push Doidge down the pecking order. So whether he said, "Look, I want to go home," you know what I mean, "I won't make life difficult for you. I'll still play, but if you can get me out of here, then get me home." As you say, Yilmaz possibly wants to go closer to his home and to his Turkish home. Yilmaz has also possibly been told by the Turkish manager, "Listen, you're in my thoughts for the Euros and whatever, but in Scotland, I'm sorry, you're not going to pick you if you're playing there. So if you can get a move to a better league and be playing regularly, you know, you might." I don't know, I'm speculating, that might be part of the reason for it. So, I mean, as Richie was saying, it would be very strange if we let Yilmaz go without having a replacement lined up. And if that replacement's Josh Doig, it would be interesting to see what the deal is. Would it be a straight swap? Would it be a swap plus cash? If there is a swap plus cash, which direction's the cash going in? Like, are we getting it? Are they getting it? You know, I don't know what the hell is Verona value on that? I've got no idea. Absolutely no idea what anybody values Doyle. You get, I believe, from listening to other sources, that there's a lot of other clubs in English Championship looking at him. Torino are also partly looking at him. Now, if it is he wants to get back to Britain, then Torino's off the table, because that would be daft. You wouldn't leave one Italian club to go to another if you're homesick. And I'm guessing that might be a reason for it, because the boy seems to be doing okay out there. Haven't seen any of them at all since he left Hibs. Didn't see much of him at Hibs, because I don't particularly watch anybody else. But I know he was a player that was well quoted for us, so I could see it happening, but it would be folly for us to let Ridvan go without having a replacement lined up. But as the boys have been saying in the comments, you know, he's a sellable asset. We don't have many of them. We don't have many sellable assets that we can sell, you know, and without that we could probably replace him. And I expect Borna to go this window if we get any kind of money in for him at all, and he's happy to go. I would say he'll probably leave. But he might just sit tight. Borna might just sit tight and say, well, look, if somebody's willing to give the club 500 grand, wait till June and give it to me, because he's out of contract anyway. But the club might force his hand and say, look, we're not going to play you if that's the scenario. So you won't be playing for Croatia because you're not playing for us. So we might be able to force that move, if you like, because there's no way in the world that Borna's getting a new contract. So if we can even bring in three or 400 grand from that, you know, that would help. It would also get him off the wage bill, and he must be one of the higher earners, given he's been here a long time and he's an established international player. So I think we're looking to bring in two left-backs, so that would make it even more ridiculous that we sold Yilmaz and didn't have somebody else lined up to come in.
Yeah, I agree. And like I say, this is all rumour at the moment, but it does seem to be gaining a bit of traction out there, so certainly one to kind of keep an eye on. And I'm total agreement. If it does happen, then we have to have a replacement in there, but that to me doesn't stop then the search for another left back, because as Wilf says, I think Borna will be on his way come the summer. Okay, obviously there are other kind of rumours going out there. I'm not going to spend a great deal of time going over every single one, because we could potentially be here all day, but let's go on to then why we were here in terms of a kind of a review of the season. Like say, we were going to do the season so far, we're going to do it all in a one, and then we thought, well, actually no, why don't we split it and cover what the kind of Michael Beale period, and then let's say the guys will come back and finish off with Clement. I think what we'll try and do, and I know it's really difficult, you know, it's easy to kind of I'll try and ask some questions and try and get your thoughts as and what they were at the time, you know. It's easy now with hindsight to kind of look at certain things, but I'll start then by just talking in terms of Michael Beale. He'd obviously been the previous November he'd got appointed. Fair to say that I think there were some positives. There were also negatives. So positives being that we started to win games that we hadn't been winning under Gio, particularly away from home. I think actually in the 23 games towards the end of that season, Michael Beale had more points than Ange Postecoglou, for example. So he had done a kind of decent job in that point. He had Todd Cantwell and Nicholas Raskin came in, which I think the fans could get behind. I think there was a kind of momentum in that and a kind of optimism in terms of signing targets, and we will talk about the summer window. But negatives, I think there was a kind of growing kind of feeling in terms of that when it came to the big games, he didn't get it over the line. So we lost a cup final, we lost a semi-final against Celtic. Yes, we did win against Celtic in the league, but that was a bit of a dead rubber game towards the end of the season. Connor, coming to you, and if you think back to going into that summer period, where were you at with regards to Michael Beale? Were you optimistic about what could potentially happen? Did you have any concerns at that point, or did he have your backing?
Look, he had my backing in as much as any Rangers manager who's there will always have my backing. You know, I always want them to do well. And because the way we had sort of finished last season, you know, I had a reasonable enough belief that he could kick us on this year. Of course, the as you touched on there, the one of the concerns was around the big games, because to that point under him, we hadn't won those big games. You know, we had an Old Firm at Ibrox, for example, where we're 2-3 minutes away from winning that game. And I think that might have been, was that his first one? I think it might have been, or his second one. And we blew it, you know, we threw it away by, you know, the same kind of stuff we'd seen for a long time in terms of defending and stuff. And, you know, so there was a frustration there. My main concern started to come with the transfers that we were bringing in. And people can go back and see this. I was a punter at the time, and I had phoned in the phone in and spoke about Lammers and Dessers when they were kind of announced that they were coming in, and voiced at that point my concerns over the quality of these players that we were bringing in, simply because these were two guys who were attacking players whose stats over not just one bad season, but over a couple of seasons, didn't make, particularly Lammers more than Dessers, but Dessers as well, to me, the concern was they didn't make great reading for guys that were going to come in and be Rangers strikers and obviously replace, you know, Morelos and Colak, who had obviously decided to let go, which, again, in hindsight being a wonderful thing, that was clearly a mistake, probably, to let Colak go. So I definitely had my concerns, but...
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
You know, there was still that belief that, well, he's scouted these players, he's identified them, we've got to give him the chance to succeed and give her backing for that point. But for game one at Kilmarnock, you know, almost from the off, you lose that opening game. Now, listen, look, you know, we all know that lot across the other side of the city, they've been to Rugby Park twice and lost twice this season. So I'm not saying that it's an easy place to go, because McInnes has got them playing quite well at home. But when you start the way we did, and we didn't look more concerningly any kind of a threat in front of goal in that game, we didn't really offer anything. That did start to make the wheels turn. But, you know, as you expect, we did go on a bit of a run and get a couple of results here and there. And so I think, yeah, initially you had that faith in him. Of course, the other issue for me was the fact that I was always slightly uncomfortable with the way Michael Beale came to get the job in the first place, just in terms of, we all knew at the time that Gio, sadly, his time was up. You know, the credit he had in the bank for getting us to the Europa League final was starting to drain, because he was losing games he just shouldn't be losing. You know, he's losing away to St Johnstone, which is, we don't lose those games, we just don't. You know, we're in the St Mirren result as well, it just was piling on. But what I never felt helped him in any way was that weeks before Gio was sacked, and before anything, Michael Beale, who at the time was the Queen's Park Rangers manager, is sitting in the director's box, rubbing shoulders with board members and stuff. That has always, that always felt a bit of an uncomfortable look for me. However, I wasn't disappointed that he came back to the club, because there was that intrigue about, what's he going to do next? Can he kick on and do, you know, what we kept getting told? He was this great coach, great tactical mind. So that's what I was expecting for that point.
Richie, to pick up on that there, and also the point that RFC 72 has just made there, Ross Wilson left in April of last year. Now, either the club weren't in a position to go out and appoint somebody to replace him straight away, or they were unwilling to do that at that point. But it left Michael Beale in sole charge, and also it was almost a role that he seemed to relish. Now, he's made some comments recently which might go against that, but he was very keen to point out that he wanted to lead in terms of our summer transfer business. He wanted to meet all the players, he wanted to look them in the eye, all of that kind of narrative that you get. Given Ross Wilson's track record signings, and I don't think Ross Wilson was universally liked, let's say that, across the piece by Rangers fans, where were you in terms of allowing a manager that total control and transfers compared to the approach that we're now going to see now that we've got a new director of football in place?
Yeah, well, this is kind of, it goes back to what you said at the start of trying to, hindsight's a wonderful thing. So it's really trying to, consider exactly how I felt at the time without the knowledge of how things have played out. And the part of me was pleased with it because he was saying all of the right things. I liked the kind of old school, if you will, approach to your manager being able to select their own targets. We'd had frustrations with some of the Ross Wilson activity. It seemed like something a bit different. I was quite excited by the number of players that were being linked with as well, and the activity. There were players that were leaving, of course, a number of big players coming to the end of their contracts. And it felt during the summer of quite a fresh approach. And I have to be honest, it seems stupid now, but I was quite excited by it. But I think that rather than the signings themselves, I think it was just because I was just desperately wanting things to become a bit better, you know, and then I think that can sometimes get the better of you. It looks like a very poor decision, of course, and I'm pleased that we've moved back to a DOF or sporting director model. In terms of his comments, I think it's interesting because everybody jumped on, you know, his remarks about, you know, maybe he was put in a position that he didn't want to be in despite having said all of the right things. I think a lot of the things that he's done and the way it's played out, it was his dream job. He won a ticket for the lottery. He was obviously, it looks to me like he was just telling everybody what they wanted to hear. I'm sure he was given the option of having this greater level of control, or maybe even it was encouraged because it suited the board at that time, because they might not have identified a target, or for whatever reason it might have suited them for that period for him to take the reins there. And it's not likely that he was going to come out in any press conferences and say, you're not going to believe what this lot have got me doing, it's absolutely ridiculous. So he was always going to put on that kind of front, but if it doesn't work for you, then it completely blows up, and it's hard to say after the event that you were given too much and this, that, and the other, because ultimately that's what he'd signed up for. But it's also possible that he's learned from the experience as well, at our detriment, unfortunately. So yeah, in answer to your question, I did allow myself to get a little bit carried away, but yeah, it's with hindsight, yeah, we're obviously on a much better track now, and it feels like there's a reason why a lot of the big clubs have clear strategies and director of football models, because it's a huge job if you're having to take care of all these different departments.
Well, he was backed in the summer, I don't think it's a criticism that can be levelled at the board that he was given a lot of money. Richie's talked about the fact that we were losing some big names and big players for us, who some have maybe stayed a little too long, but in terms of like a McGregor, your Morelis's, your Kent's, etc., these were players that that fans had grown to love, who'd put in big performances over a number of seasons. But he brought in a number of players, Danilo, Dessers, Lammers, Butland, Sima, Dowell, Cifuentes, Sterling, Balogun all came in. Where, given that the players I've mentioned that came in, the players that left, and you had Hadji going out on loan, and then Sakala. Where were you looking at our transfer business? Were you happy about it? Did you still think we were lacking in centre areas, or did you have that optimism that, which I think was spreading across the support?
Yeah, I was quietly optimistic when you brought in players I knew nothing about. I mean, obviously we've heard the names, you know, Dessers, Lammers. As Connor said a few minutes ago, their stats weren't great. But I mean, you had one of them was the leading scorer in the first edition of the Conference League. You know, I mean, 10 goals for Feyenoord. That's in any European competition, that's decent goal scoring. So you've got to think, well, in a decent team, then, you know, the guy's going to score your goals. I felt a little bit sorry for Michael Beale because Ross Wilson had allowed, well, I'm going to blame Ross Wilson because he was the director of football at the time, has allowed a lot of our big players to run out of contract. You know, he lost a lot of big players at the same time for no money. So he was hamstrung in that regard. He basically had to rebuild the whole team. But I mean, from the first transfer window we had a year ago in the January window, he brought in two players we all thought great. They hit the ground running. You know, Cantwell and Raskin had come in. Well, we're all singing their praises, saying great. If that's the level of player he's bringing in, then, you know, we're on a surefire hit here. You know, but it was players that I hadn't heard of. The problem for me was it was the same rhetoric for them all. Every player was going to be a game changer. You know, he chased the Fuentes for months and months and months because he was going to be the game changer. You know, and then he came in and he didn't play him for whatever reason. He wasn't getting a game. And, you know, he was saying, oh, he'd be tracking these players for two and three seasons. And knowing now, if we knew them what we know now, you've got to wonder, was he going off the reputation from the last time you saw him 2 or 3 years ago? Was that what he was using as his deciding factor to say, well, I'm going to sign these guys because when I watched them two and a half seasons ago, they were decent players, they were doing this, they were doing that. You know, okay, they've maybe moved on, careers haven't been great. So, but yeah, I mean, I was quietly optimistic. The thing that really got me though, and it's since we decided we were doing this, it's the one thing that I don't think was mentioned a lot at the time that really had alarm bells for me was the pre-season that he had organised. Because obviously you've got to say, because there's no director of football in there, he has to be the man that organised the pre-season. Now, the pre-season games, well, they were glamorous because they were always going to be glamorous. But I can't help thinking, were they against too high a level of opposition from, you know,
well, actually, I was going to bring this up. So I'm really glad you've got, because that was actually my next point about pre-season. And I kind of agree with you. It seems now to be a bit of a mantra now with managers that they really want to test their teams. And I get that. But is going straight into a game against Newcastle United, then Hamburg, then Olympiacos, and then going away to Hoffenheim, is there a kind of a thought process that actually, do you know what, it would maybe be quite good if you played some team of a lesser standing and you maybe put 7 or 8 goals by them, just, you know, to kind of build a bit of momentum. That Newcastle game, I remember, I mean, they were way behind us in their schedule, but you noticed the difference. And Eddie Howe set them up to say, here's my first 11, I want 45 minutes from yous, run yourselves into the ground. And they caused us real, real issues. So I'm glad you brought that up, because I've had that same feeling in terms of, I wonder if he got just the standard a bit wrong, gradually build it up.
Well, for me, Stuart, so I'll come back in. For me, the Newcastle one was really strange because that was Alan McGregor's testimonial. Right? Now, Alan McGregor, to my knowledge, has got no dealings with Newcastle. Newcastle's not any part of his history or his career. I would have expected somebody like Hull City, because he played with Hull City, you know, to come up and be the opposition for, and he left on decent terms with them, I think. You know, so it's not as if there'd be animosity there. And yeah, okay, Newcastle's going to fill the ground. They brought up a fantastic support, 7,000 or 8,000, which was absolutely brilliant. But for McGregor's testimonial, we'd have filled it, supposing we were playing, you know, the Rangers rabble 11, but still have filled Ibrox for Griggs's testimonial. You know, so I thought that was a bit strange. As you say, they were, you know, they were behind us, but miles ahead of us, behind us in the training, but miles ahead of us in ability. The Hamburg game, I thought, was probably just about right, because, which coincidentally is the only game that we won. because there's an affinity there. You're going to get a crowd in. They're in the Zweite Bundesliga, so they're not a top German team at the moment. You know, that's probably just about right. Olympiakos, that seemed to come out of nowhere. That was really, really strange. And Hoffenheim, it was a fantastic trip, but they're a very, very good Bundesliga team who, as you say, would probably be better playing teams that we could probably have got a win against, because winning's a habit, you know. And you want to challenge your players, but you also want to give the fans something back, you know. I just think it was too heavy a pre-season. It was too high a standard a pre-season. I'm not saying we should have been playing junior clubs or clubs from lower leagues, but it could have been probably a lot more out Scottish football's level than what we played.
Yeah, I'd agree. And, you know, Bebab Bob said there, you know, thanks very much for the donation. And yeah, you know, tracing it back to the moment that Gerrard left. And, you know, we were ahead of Celtic at that point, and you can kind of trace it back from there. Connor, we then, you know, the pre-season, I think it says a lot that Sam Lammers, now with hindsight, was probably the standout player during pre-season. I actually really liked the look of Lammers at that time. But it took us into then Champ League qualifiers. And I think we knew we would have to go through two qualifiers to get back to the Champions League. I think we would have been quite happy with the first draw when we drew Servette, the Swiss side. But we made hard work of it. You know, it was a kind of tough watch. And I remember thinking at that point, and I was probably didn't want to admit it to myself, but I did have some worries in terms of the level of performance that we'd seen in pre-season. And then in those games, it was causing a bit of a concern, whilst also telling myself it's still early and there's still a lot of new players. But it was a bit of a tough watch, and that kind of new style of football that we'd been promised from Beale, we weren't really seeing it.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. Just before I touch on that main point there with the pre-season thing, that's something we seem to do a lot of, though, because the year before, if you remember, we played Tottenham, we played Real Madrid. You know, again, for me, you can have one of those games in there, but that was still too high a standard even for getting into that season. We still had new players to bed in then as well, but we just seem to like to turn up and let's go and give ourselves games against the hardest opponents we can find at the time, when actually a game or two against a Hull City or whatever else isn't a bad thing to do either, just to get minutes in the legs and get players, you know, like your new attackers, for example, on the score sheet, although I'm pretty sure, if memory serves, Sam Lammers did actually score in one of those pre-season games.
Scored against Newcastle, yes.
But on the central point about the qualifiers after that, I think there were definitely seeds of doubt, you could say, that were sort of sown in there a little bit with the Servette game, because it was that kind of one way where we at Ibrox, we dominated that game. Servette offered absolutely nothing at Ibrox for me. They really didn't. And we got into a 2-0 lead, you know, and you're thinking, right, this is looking good, let's go and kill this game off now, get that third goal, and it doesn't just kill the first leg, but it pretty much kills the tie overall, because even though you're going away there, unless you have an absolute nightmare against a team like Servette, you're not going to concede four. And we just didn't do it. And we let them hang about in the game for too long, and then, of course, you know, they get, was it the free kick, I think, from a mistake, from a challenge we don't need to make, and bang. You know, they've got
Sam Lammers had missed an open goal to make it 3-0, and then they immediately went apart, didn't they?
Yes, well, I was going to make that point as well, but yeah, I've just went slightly out of order, but you're correct. So obviously you miss that big chance, then you let them back into it with that goal. And that was always going to mean that going over there, it was going to then be a bit nervier than it ever had to be, because the reality was they would have been absolutely delighted to get out of Ibrox that night, just the one goal behind, and would have fancied that they could level the tie up quickly at home and then make it difficult for us, which they did. But in a lot of ways, the away leg was sort of a typical away performance for us in Europe of recent times anyway, because I think apart from obviously Betis, which was outstanding. And but prior to that, going to that point, I think apart from like the Dortmund game and maybe Red Star Belgrade, we had had some sticky patches in the away games in Europe. We'd never really been blown away. You know, we got through the games anyway at home, but they did cause us problems. But you did just, you know, more from, as I say, the first leg and the second leg. You did have that worry about our just how clinical we could be, our ability to kill a game like that off. Because the thing it does as well, obviously, is if you can kill that game off in the first leg, it would have given more of an opportunity to explore maybe rotating the squad a bit more. Do you put one or two other players in to get that exposure and that experience that you need? And as it was, obviously, we didn't have it. And then, of course, we moved on to the PSV game, which, to be perfectly honest with you, when you look back on it, and I've seen the highlights 101 times, the fact that we got a 2-2 draw at home, that could so easily, the way that game went for spells, you know, that could have been anything as well for both sides in that game, because we had plenty of chances in that game, as we usually do at home, but so did PSV. They had a few real golden opportunities themselves, you know, but I think that result maybe gave us a bit of false hope in terms of, well, we've got this 2-2 result, you know, mirror image to the year before when we drew 2-2 in the first leg. And you just thought, well, do you know what? We've done this before. Went over the last year, got to 1-0 win and get down the road. And there was maybe that bit of belief that we had enough to just get over the finishing line. But we learned very, very quickly. I think in PSV, we learned a real sore lesson. That, don't get me wrong, I do feel the Betis game and the Prague game in the Europa League, I kind of feel like we kind of made up for slightly, albeit the less said about, you know, the trip to Cyprus, the better. But I think those moments, it's costly for the club as well, because last year, obviously, qualifying, we got, you know, what, 30, you know, million pound in the bank just from getting there. And then, okay, it was not a great campaign, but, you know, I want to be playing in the Champions League all day long, like we all do. So that was a huge, I think, miss. And I think the confidence, it must have took a dip, the confidence in some of these players, particularly the new players coming in, who no doubt will have done some homework on Rangers and will have seen this is a club that's been into a European final. This is a club, you know, that's been doing well in Europe over the last couple of years. Some of the players that were there as well, not really covering themselves in glory with that one. And I think that must have took a massive hit for the confidence in trying to build back for that as well. And even for Beal as a manager, because that's a steep learning curve for you in European football as a manager.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Yeah, absolutely. Before I come to you, Richie, just a big shout out to one of our partners, which are Football Prizes. Martin has put a link in the description for the show tonight. There's a competition running. Guys at Football Prizes have very generously put up a signed James Tavernier top for you guys, the opportunity to win that. So please click on to the link and have a look at Football Prizes when you get a chance. Thanks very much for their ongoing support. Richie, Connor's touched on it then. You know, we go into a second leg with a bit of optimism. I think that draw at Ibrox, there were periods in that game where it's potentially the highlight of Michael Beale's, certainly this season. You know, some of our play during that period. But we go to Eindhoven, and Wilf, I know you would have been there, it falls apart very, very quickly, doesn't it? And I think I'm a bit of a realist to know that we could play PSV every season and, you know, it's going to be a tough game against them. They looked as if they'd improved. but it was the manner, Richie, that we lost. You know, to lose 5-1, there was some, you know, a calamitous own goal from Conor Goldson. We looked, every set piece looked as if we were going to concede goals. It was just a horrendous night at the office.
Yeah, no, it was. And as Conor touched upon, there were shades of that in the first leg as well, particularly in the first half. There were spells there when we were really under the cosh, and it was two moments of sort of near individual brilliance that got us the two goals there. And admittedly, you know, it almost turned into a game of basketball in the second half there. It could have easily gone 3-1 rather than 2 each. And then, you know, we could have been defeated if ifs and buts. We'd seen from the performances towards the start of the season that, you know, it was possible that a team as explosive as PSV could put this kind of score on us. You know, particularly, like, we were talking in the build-up to the games about how Borna and Tav can be exposed by, you know, being, if they find themselves too high up the pitch, there's that ball in behind them all the time. And the PSV have got their sort of dynamic three up front that can, you know, really clinically get to you. And it was just, it was a horrendous night when, yeah, the stuffing completely came out of the European campaign. One thing that I found interesting and I really didn't like in the build-up was the way that Beal was talking about the competition. It was almost like, well, we've got a free hit at the Champions League, but we're already in a European competition. So, yeah, you know, that was the narrative. And I didn't, whatever he wants to say to the group of players or however he's actually feeling about it, I mean, that might be one that he saves for the boardroom to say, listen, guys, temper your expectations. This might be a Europa League campaign. It's just not what I wanted to hear when we had what I felt was, you know, a fairly winnable tie, or at least a tie that we had every right to be very competitive in. I didn't like that at all. And, you know, I think not to go too far on a tangent, but I think his handling of the media was, you know, was very poor throughout. But that, yeah, the 5-1 and the manner of that was really where things began to unravel, and I'm sure you're going to take us on to the following game, which was where was my kind of real sort of vote of no confidence at that point.
Well, yeah, I mean, the league season had started, and these games, and Conor touched on the fact that we went to Rugby Park, and I think firstly, you know, a team selection came out where the player that we had got really excited about over the second half of the previous season, and Todd Cantwell, was on the bench. Seemed a bit strange. Don't think we've ever really kind of got to the bottom. Look, a manager's got the prerogative. They can select a team. We could still be playing now in terms of that game, Wilf, and probably wouldn't have got the goal. We get a sucker punch, and already that kind of optimism that fans had went into the season, there was already supporters starting to make grumbles that they don't see this ending well. It was a really, really poor performance that day at Rugby Park.
Yeah, it was ridiculously poor. I mean, as you say, we could still be playing now, we probably wouldn't have scored. It was just such a body blow after. You know, this was the sort of game when Beal came in, this was the sort of game that he was winning, as you touched on at the start. You know, he came in and he was winning games that Van Bronckhorst hadn't been winning, because the away form under Van Bronckhorst was fairly poor. But Beal was coming in and he wasn't blowing these other teams away, but he was winning the games. We were getting positive results. Then we went to the Rugby Park, we couldn't kick our own arse. I mean, we were dreadful. No Todd Cantwell. I mean, Cantwell had been his talisman, if you like, since he brought him in January last year. And he came in and just nothing. He wasn't even there. Now, you've got to perceive that he was saving him for the Servette game at Ibrox in the midweek. But you've got to conclude, knowing what we know about Servette, that they shouldn't even have been thinking about that, because we could probably beat Servette without Todd Cantwell on the team, because they're, as Conor said, they weren't a great side, because they're Swiss. You know what I mean? They're not particularly that good, particularly we've been in Europe. So, yeah, that was a very strange one. The whole start to the season was really poor. The football wasn't great either. And the Killie game on top of the pre-season, which we touched on, when we only beat Hamburg, you know, losing to Newcastle, losing to Panathinaikos, you know, the draw in Hoffenheim when really we should have got beat. You know, go to Kilmarnock. Rangers teams that win things don't lose at Kilmarnock. It's as simple as that. You just don't do that. And yeah, okay, they've done well this season. They've beat the other lot twice at Rugby Park, and that's tremendous. But I mean, now you don't a Rangers team with that amount of new players, that amount of so-called good talent. Because I mean, Michael Beale certainly talked a good game. You know, I mean, he could probably sell sand to the Arabs. You know, he talks a very, very good game. I mean, for me, he said far too much, and the current manager doesn't say enough. You know, although having said that, Van Bronckhorst said less than Clement, but that's another story. But no, Kilmarnock, poor. Then obviously we go back on the horse. We beat Servette at Ibrox. We then went on to beat Livingston, and then we went over to Switzerland, and we were probably lucky to get out of Dodge still being in the competition.
Yeah, we did that, and we got a victory, let's just say, Livy at home. We went to Dingwall, we beat Ross County. And then Connor, it's the first Old Firm game of the season. And you're coming up against a Celtic side that had injuries, a makeshift back four, I think would be fair to say. And we've seen that recently as well. And a team are probably under a bit of pressure. You know, Rodgers was under pressure at that time in terms of they did some poor results, they'd been knocked out the cup, etc. And yes, we had a goal disallowed, which to this day I still think is a perfectly, perfectly good goal. And you know, these are the small things that could potentially change. You know, Rangers could go on and win that game, and you know, you suddenly build a bit of momentum. But I think overall, I think as a group of fans, we were surprised at how timid and negative we were in that game. The tactics to stand off and allow, like say, a makeshift back four and Callum McGregor to kind of run the show. And of course, then we get hit with a sucker punch just before half time. At this point, do you remember, because I think that result made up the minds of a lot of people at that point. You know, it was our second defeat of the season already in the league on the back of losing out on Champions League qualification. Had you made up your mind then, or were you still, it's still too early to make that decision?
No, I think at that point, I hadn't really, you know, fully turned against him just yet. I think probably what helped him sort of cover it up a little bit was the fact that he could point to being unlucky to have a perfectly legitimate goal ruled out. You know, I know poor officiating against us in a Celtic game, who'd have thought it, lads? You know, so he had that to almost kind of hide behind his own failings to some degree, not entirely, because of course, as you see, you know, it was a very timid performance, and the goal we conceded was just criminal defending, but it epitomised a lot of the problems that we were having, you know, when it came to our defensive shape at that point as well. And to be fair, that we're still having now, because that very same kind of, okay, that one's more of a mistake, it's sort of flicked back from the midfield, I think, for just a sort of long ball, and you know, Kyogo's somehow found himself in the middle of two centre backs who the space between the two, I mean, you could have fit a double decker bus in it. It was ridiculous, the space between the two of them. And we've seen that since then, of course. We've seen it at Pittodrie with Majowski, even in more recent times. So that's not necessarily gone away, but we'll touch on that in the next show. But it was then the idea that we offered nothing after that. It's the idea that we're playing at home in front of, you know, 50 plus thousand of our own fans at Ibrox, and we've not used that atmosphere to our advantage, and we've not gone and got the, you know, a goal to get back into it. And then, because I think if we had equalised in that game, I think we'd have went on and won it, because I think that back line that Celtic had were there for the taking, much like the back line they had at Celtic Park recently. They were there for the taking, and we just didn't, you know, we didn't take advantage of it. And I think the proof's in the pudding, because, you know, two of those boys who started that game, you know, Narowski's only just got back into their team, and Lager Bielka has scarcely been seen. You know, he's made one or two appearances, I think, for them since then, but not many. So, you know, it was a missed opportunity. But one of my problems with Michael Beale when it came to the Old Firm games, but that one and the ones last season as well, it never seemed to get under his skin. It never seemed to annoy him and anger him the way that it does for us as fans, and the way that it used to do for the likes of Ali McCoist when he was, you know, managing against him, or Walter Smith, moreover, when he was there, and some of the better, you know, like Souness and that, the better managers we've had. It just never seemed to, even Gerrard seemed to get it more than Bill when he was there. He seemed to have the passion about it, at least up his sleeve, and that might be because he came from Merseyside Derby and stuff, and there's an element of that there, but that was always my frustration about him. He kind of just accepted the defeats and went, okay, well, we'll move on, we'll learn from it, and we'll do this and come back the next time, and you never really felt like you did learn anything. And I think that was probably the bigger frustration, and how reactive he was in those moments, because we can't take away the fact that a lot of the time he never changed it, never made subs, particularly in those big games when it wasn't working, until it was too late for him to have any kind of impact either. So, and I wasn't there yet in terms of Beale out, but that might in part have been because there were certain things in that game out with his control, like the decisions for the officials, that you can kind of go, well, he can almost get a pass for that, but it was very much, it was in a sugary peg at that point.
Richie, are you surprised he survived that? I'm a big believer that when the majority of Rangers fans have made their mind up about you, you know, as a player, there's potential that you can get back in. We've seen some players do that, but the majority don't. I think with a manager, it's, you know, he could have won the next five games, but as soon as we drop points again, the fans would have just reacted. And we always did see that. I mean, that's kind of how it played out, because, you know, we then won our next two games, and then we threw in a performance against Aberdeen, which ultimately cost him his job. But are you surprised that the board didn't react straight after the Celtic game, given what we were seeing, the style of play? You know, this was real horseshoe stuff at times. The promise of this free-flowing, high-press football, we barely ever saw it. Are you surprised he survived after that game?
Yeah, very surprised. Yeah, not least because of the result, but yeah, the nature of the performance, the decisions that he made, and that was certainly the, like yourself, I had my kind of reservations around Savet. Not so much in pre-season. I was still kind of thinking, well, difficult opposition, team are gelling, all that, you know, the usual stuff that we were talking about at the time. But it just wasn't getting any better. And the way he was chopping and changing was really concerning me as well. It didn't seem to know his best 11 or their positions. And his in-game management was so poor, I thought. So the 60-minute substitutions, the refusal to act upon what we could all see as games were being played out. So, yeah, that's the point at which I was expecting that the trigger might have been pulled. And I always remember Kerr saying a few times in the sort of pre-season, we're spending quite a bit of money here, and this needs to start going well very quickly, or else he's going to be under extreme pressure. And that kind of stayed with me. But it was always clear that, you know, even if he wasn't getting the chop after that result, which of course he didn't, like you said, he was on it. It was your next game, next defeat, next terrible performance. That might have been 5, 6, 7, 8 games down the line. It was always coming for him. And and ultimately, yeah, it did. It came for him on that Sunday evening after the defeat to Aberdeen. at Ibrox. And but to answer your question, I think they'd have been well within their rights to have pulled the trigger after that disastrous display in the defeat to Celtic. But then part of me, after they didn't do that, I was then thinking, are they just going to hold on here? I almost went sort of full circle and trying to second guess what they were going to do. I thought, is this going to just get to the ridiculous stage where they've made this? Because you can look at it the other way and say, well, they've invested in him so much that are they just going to just, you know, listen to whatever nonsense he's feeding them in the same way that he was with some of the press conferences. But, you know, it's it happened. It had to happen after that game. And yeah, exactly, Galen. Yeah, he'd lost. Like, I don't know. I mean, even you can talk about pre-season and some reservations that some people had, or like some people seem to think that he was a bad manager from when his mom was cradling him in the hospital. You know, you get all kinds of these takes, but ultimately, like, there was nobody in any of the WhatsApp groups that I'm in that was sort of saying, give him a bit more time, this is going to work. And that's when you know that your P45's in the post, isn't it?
Absolutely. No half-season review would be complete without mentioning that after that Celtic game, then Kerr made an appearance on a well-known bookmaker's fan denial series by calling him a Cockney car salesman. I'm not sure Martin's ever got the royalties for that enough, but that was a bit of light-hearted fun in what was a kind of difficult period. The Aberdeen game, chances galore Rangers created that day. The game should have been out of sight, but possibly some of the worst defending I've ever seen from a Rangers team that day. All three goals were absolutely horrific to watch. And at that, well, I mean, I would say probably, you know, when the third goal goes in, Michael Beale probably already knows the writing's on the wall, because Ibrox was making its feelings known that day.
Yeah, I think he probably realised after the second goal went in, because after that horrendous Celtic defeat, you know, as Gallant said in the comment we just brought up, that he lost all the fans that day. That was it. The whole lot. I didn't speak to a single Rangers fan that thought, he's got time. Every single one of us said, next defeat, he's gone. If the next defeat's next week, next month, turn of the year, he's gone. It's the next defeat. Unless you can get to the January window and in the other side of that, you know, without dropping any more points, which really isn't going to happen. Then he redeemed himself somewhat when he beat Betis. Yep. Ibrox, I mean, that ultimately led to us winning the group, and, you know, getting straight in the last 16. So we'll have to thank him for that. Like, that's something that he did. How he managed to do that in the form the team was in, I've got absolutely no idea. But I mean, back to that Aberdeen game, I mean, they probably did Rangers a favour by beating us that day, because it got rid of Michael Beale, because he was only a defeat away from getting, you know, as you say, from getting jettisoned. But the first, if you remember that game, the first 25 minutes, Aberdeen couldn't get out of their own box, never went out of their own half. It was like the Alamo, and we just couldn't score, which probably sums up Michael Beale's tenure in charge of Rangers. Made loads and loads of chances, couldn't score goals. And that's ultimately what cost them, because really, if we had taken even 20% of the chances we made in that first 25 minutes, Michael Beale would possibly still be in a job at Rangers, because we would have absolutely steamrolled on Aberdeen, that in the bottom a lot more time. You know, because we would have hammered them, we'd probably put six past them, but we just couldn't score. Then, as you say, the defending was laughable. I mean, the goals they scored, because Aberdeen, I mean, we say that Celtic team that beat us was a poor side. That Aberdeen team are a shambles, and they were a shambles then. I mean, their manager was complaining, they're playing too many games with Europe, they can't train, they can't do this. They were getting beat by everybody. They were throwing points all over the place, you know, and they came and beat us. I mean, after that defeat, if it hadn't been for the fact that they'd beat us, they'd have been bottom of the league. That's how bad Aberdeen were at that time, you know. And after the weather, the early storm that we, let's say, they couldn't get out their own half, they made us look very, very ordinary. And he had to go after that. He just had to. I mean, as the boys were saying, after that Celtic game's when he should have gone.
Yeah, I agreed. Conor, we'll start wrapping up, conscious of time. But, you know, when we look back at his tenure, then He goes away with actually the second highest win rate of any Rangers manager. Only Ali McCoist has a higher win rate, but when you consider that a lot of Ali's games were in the lower divisions, he's got a win rate of 72.1%. So when you actually on the face of it look at that, it just shows of that really tough world that of an Old Firm manager, isn't it? In terms of, because you're going to be judged on those big games, which we weren't showing any signs that we were going to win, and a style of football that we'd been promised that wasn't materialising. Richie touched on the fact that press conferences, you know, saying something one week and then there was a contradiction the following week, possibly offering too much information. You know, January transfer window, remember we looked as if we were going to have signings straight in the door. Then we were, no, it was right at the tail end. We finally got them. It was a board making it what feels like now when you look back on it, a decision to appoint them because they knew them and they needed to bring somebody in. It just didn't work, did it?
No, and I think that's it. You know, it was at the time when he came in, it was clear that the board fancied him. He'd been there before, as you say. It was in their minds, was probably a reliable set of hands because they thought, well, we know what he's about. We know what he brought as a coach. You know, surely can bring out as a manager. I think in a lot of ways you can put it down to saying, had Michael Beale had a few more years under his belt at QPR or whatever else and had more experience and then came in, then it could have turned out better for him because he'd have been better for having that experience behind him. But for him to come in so soon in his tenure, come in a controversial way in terms of the way he left QPR, you know, he had seemingly already turned down Wolves prior to that. And then the minute we came in, you know, he was off. And then everything, obviously, that I touched on earlier about even the circumstances and how he got appointed. And it's just one of those ones that it might be a case to you know, he came in too soon in his managerial career. But as the commenter said earlier, you know, Rangers managers aren't necessarily judged on win rates. It's about winning trophies. And the one thing you can say is that Michael Beale, when he first came into the job, had virtually the same opportunity that Philip Clement had to win a trophy. In terms of, he came in and inherited a squad that were already in a semi-final of a cup competition. Now, some would say, well, he had the harder game because obviously he had to play, you know, against Celtic and stuff in that cup. But ultimately, he had the chance to, very early on in his career, solidify a piece of silverware that would automatically buy you a bit of goodwill and good grace amongst the fans. And unfortunately for him, he just didn't do it. He could talk the talk, but hence the Cockney Gal salesman. He could definitely talk the talk. He still can. I mean, I obviously, as a Newcastle fan, was delighted to see him getting gubbed for Sunderland at the weekend. And he came out, you could literally copy and paste half the interviews he'd done in his time with us in that post-match he'd done for Sunderland about how they're going to learn the lessons. It's a good learning curve and everybody will be better for it. So you can sell you a good game. But I just think, yeah, a case of too soon for me. And arguably, even the team around about him wasn't good enough, because I don't think Neil Banfield done him any favours when he came out and spoke to the press either. So, no, he had to go when he did. And just to be very clear, because I've had a few people have a go at me in the chats, after the Celtic game, I wasn't sitting here saying, oh, you know, absolutely Beale in. I just wasn't totally screaming the house down saying he had to go. But when the Aberdeen game came, and you can go and watch that post-match reaction, I was on with Martin that day, and I can't remember who else it was I was on with, and it was a lively one. It was a very, Craig it was, and none of us were happy that day. We wanted him sacked by the time Martin finished his opening spiel, you know, because at that point it was game over. So, yeah, I think it was just a case of too soon and not experienced enough a manager for the job he got. Too much for him.
Richie, Wilf, any kind of final thoughts from yourselves on Beale's tenure? Should we just be thankful that he's given us Jack Butland?
Yeah, well, he's the standout signing, isn't he? I think, yeah, it's difficult, like we said at the start, because we've seen how it's played out. I don't think he hasn't obviously gone into it wanting to do a bad job. That's why I'd hold the board and those that made the decisions, you know, just as accountable as him, really. And whatever happened with the level of responsibility for players and the lack of a DOF, and we'll never know the truth of that. But what we do know is it's a total disaster, and you know, it's potentially put us back some time if we've got no money to bring in additional players. So yeah, it's not going to be a period that any of us look back on without, you know, real sort of regret. And you're bound to kind of scrutinize the decision and wonder how they came to it. But as Connor alluded to, I think there was something in that. You know, Wolves were sniffing about. They had that relationship with him, and it felt like the right thing to do at the time. It will be interesting to see how he gets on. I suspect he won't do much better at Sunderland, but he's still so well respected as a coach. Like I speak to a lot of people in the Liverpool area that think he's absolutely phenomenal as a coach, and he's got such a good reputation with youth setups at, you know, in Brazil and at Chelsea, Liverpool. So I don't know, but it's a very different job, isn't it? And maybe, you know, maybe that's where he's more suited, you know, working as part of a team rather than being the head honcho. But thank God that we've got a better manager at the helm now, and we can sort of draw a line under that period of the season.
Wolf, for you, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think Richie nails it there. I think he's probably a very good coach. He was the cheap option by the board. It looked like they got away with it to start with when he came in, and you know, we did well, but he lost the big games. Let's be honest, he'd only been a manager for what, 16 games at QPR before he came to us. The thing that got everybody going was the fact he turned down Wolves, the fact that Wolves were interested in him when he'd only done a dozen or so games at QPR. No experience at that level, no experience of managing players in big games. For me, looking at his entire tenure as a whole, it was the cheap option that didn't work. The red flag should have been there when he turned up in the director's box that day when we played Aberdeen before Gio got the sack. He maintained he was only up for a pre-arranged weekend with his mates, in which case, just go into the stand, just get a ticket and go into the stand, don't sit in the director's box. You know, don't get me wrong, I was lucky enough to be in the director's box that day, and I was delighted to see him. My daughter got a photo taken with him and all that. He was the cheap option, I think. It didn't work. I don't think it'll work for him at Sunderland. I think he is a very, very good coach. I don't particularly think he's a very good man manager, because the current manager, which we'll get to on when the boys do the other pod, I think it's on Thursday, is working with the same players, and he's getting a tune out of exactly the same players, more or less, one or two of them, obviously not. But he's getting a tune out of the same players, and you notice that Philippe Clement has a word for every player he substitutes. Bill didn't even speak to him, he took them off. He just let them go. You know, so his man management skills, I don't think, obviously I haven't been at the ground with him there, whatever, so I don't really know, but it sounds like his man management wasn't particularly good. And because he was doing everything else, his coaching would have been suffering as well. So, it's just a bad choice by the board, bad experiment, didn't work. It has definitely set us back, because he spent an awful lot of money on players that haven't worked out. That can happen to any manager. The problem we've got is, which is why we're talking about possibly selling Yilmaz, we don't have the players he's brought in for big money. We're not going to get the money back on. We're not going to be able to sell them Lammers and Dessers and guys like that. If we're getting rid of these guys, it'll be on loan. We won't be able to sell them. Nobody's going to give us the money back, particularly not for the wages that they'll be on. And they're on long contracts, so we're hamstrung by all that. So, experiment that didn't work. I'll never kind of really criticise a Rangers manager too much, because it's a job I'd love to do and I couldn't do. The result against Betis ultimately helped us win the European group, for which I'll be thankful to him for, but that PSV performance, no, can never forgive that. That was just horrific.
Yeah. A big welcome to Super Sal, who's become a YouTube member. Appreciate that. Thanks for doing that. Okay, gents, look, I'll leave it there. Not an easy pod to do, but you know, I think it is useful to kind of kind of go through with a bit of hindsight in terms of these things. So I appreciate Wilf, Richie and Connor taking the time to join us. As Wilf just mentioned there, I think a few of the guys will be back on Thursday, I believe. They're going to just carry on from where we left off. So with a wee bit of Stephen Davis in between, a result in Cyprus, and then some good stuff to talk about from when Philippe Clement's come in. Hopefully you have enjoyed this, folks. Like I say, just trying to give you some content during the winter break. Yeah, like and subscribe the podcast. Share around if you haven't already done so. That would be greatly appreciated. But thanks for joining us, and we'll speak
before,
soon.
Before we run away, Stuart, it was good to bump into Super Sal before the Kilmarnock game. He was diving into hospitality, if I remember, so I hope you enjoyed that. And just to tell everyone, if they didn't see it in the comments, that there's a Rangers women's show coming on in 17 minutes, because this is going on a bit at 9 o'clock, so my missus is going to crack up, but here we go. So yeah, 9 o'clock, we're back on with the women's show, picking the bones out of yesterday's 12-0 Cup win in Inverness and talking about the Cup draw, which was made at tea time. So we'll see you all then.
Excellent. Good stuff. Well, you'll get paid overtime, I'm sure. The boss will sort that out for you. But folks, yeah, thanks very much for joining us, and we'll speak to you all soon. Cheers.
Sports Social Podcast Network. It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply.